This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The issues of sexual harassment and gender-related bias certainly are not new in science, but late last year it seemed like you could hardly scroll through the news reports without seeing another story about harassment in the sciences. There were accounts of several prominent cases, one involving an astronomer at UC Berkeley, another a curator at the American Museum of Natural History, another with an Ebola researcher at the University of Washington, and more. And Twitter hashtags like AstroSH and BioSH brought a deeper conversation about sexual harassment and gender bias in the sciences, brought them into social media. We thought this issue so important that we're going to revisit it. My guests are two reporters who have been covering stories like these, Hazeen Gureishi, science reporter at BuzzFeed News, and Michael Balter, now at Verge, who first broke the Richmond story for Science Magazine. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Michael, Brian Richmond is a story you broke in your reporting for Science. His isn't the first case of sexual assault in academia. What made that one noteworthy?
When we were discussing at Science whether to actually cover this story or not, we had to ask ourselves that exact question. Why cover this particular case when there were so many? I think that there's a couple of reasons, at least. One is that this had become a very big issue in the anthropology community that Brian Richmond was part of. It was kind of an open secret in that community, and people were trying to grapple with what to do about it. And so in a way, it was kind of a community story as well, looking at how scientists deal with this kind of situation, what they can possibly do about it. The other thing is that although I argue that how high profile a scientist is should not be a determining factor in whether we cover them or not, it was the case that Richmond was in a very high profile and public position as curator of human origins. Normally, he would be giving talks and doing the public outreach for human evolution for the entire American Museum. Mm-hmm. So I think that we felt that when you added those and some other factors together, that it was a story worth doing.
Mm-hmm. Hazeen, you reported on Jeff Marcy and Michael Cates, among others, both star researchers at the time of the investigation, yes?
Yes, I did.
What is the role of you as members of the media in reporting these stories if the institutions were already aware and disciplining these people?
Well, I mean, I can speak to the cases that I've covered. I think in the Marcy case, you know, these women had come forward after, you know, trying very many different sort of approaches, going to the department chair, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, and then had finally gone through the very taxing process of filing an official Title IX complaint, getting all the complainants together. And at the end of all that, they, you know, got a letter from UC Berkeley saying that, you know, the investigator had found that Marcy had violated sexual harassment policies, but that essentially they weren't going to do much about it. They were very vague on the details, but it was pretty clear that they were not going to discipline him and that he was going to be able to keep his job and that no one would know about it. And I think that these women decided to come forward after feeling disappointed by the process as it exists.
System failed them,
yeah.
Is what you're saying.
Yeah,
well, Michael,
exactly.
Would you agree?
Absolutely. I think in the two major cases that I've covered this year, the Brian Richmond case, and also very recently a story I did for The Verge about the case of Miguel Pinto at the Smithsonian Institution, in both cases, their institutions involved had no interest whatsoever in revealing them publicly or even internally. Both institutions did as much as they could to try to keep things quiet. I think to their credit that that's beginning to change, as a great deal has happened at the American Museum over the last year on the part of especially the Women in Science group there and other curators and faculty to try to make sure that this kind of thing can't happen again or at least diminish the possibility.
Do you think that the women doing work in science suffering from sexual harassment are any different than women in any other professions? I mean, what is there unique about this?
I mean, I think a lot has been said about whether this problem is unique to science, and some prominent people have said that that's not the case. But, you know, we're never going to have the numbers to settle that debate. the reality is that we have only seen probably the tip of the iceberg in terms of women who are brave enough to come forward about their experiences. But what we do know is that science, the way the science works, especially at research institutions like UC Berkeley or University of Washington, it's you know, it's set up differently than other workplaces. It's extremely hierarchical. These graduate students or undergrads are extremely dependent on their relationship to their PIs, who are in a great position of power. You know, they rely on them for data, for collaborations, for grants, for basically their whole career lies sort of in the balance of this relationship that you know, has to be appropriate. And you know, if it's not, it's the impetus is on the victim to really address that, and the institutions have mm-hmm. sort of a vested interest in keeping that quiet. Mm-hmm.
I want to turn now to Meg Urey, professor of physics and astronomy at Yale. She was the president of the American Astronomical Society when the story about UC Berkeley astronomer Marcy, a history of harassment, first broke. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
You were president of the AAS when one case, as I say, Jeff Marcy, came to light. What was your reaction as a leader in astronomy?
Yeah, well, it hadn't been something that was a major focus at that time, but I realized immediately we needed to respond that, you know, our professional society is the home for astronomers, and we need to support astronomers to help them thrive in their research. So we already had a pretty effective anti-harassment policy, which works when we're, you know, in charge of a venue, like at a meeting, for example, a scientific meeting. But I realized pretty quickly we needed to enhance our code of ethics to have a, you know, sort of be a statement of what is okay behavior and what is not okay behavior in the professional sphere. Mm-hmm. And we've done that now, and we are, you know, we've talked a lot about this issue, both within our society and with other professional societies in science.
Dr. Urey, you've also been a woman working in astronomy for several decades. You have a large view picture of this. Has harassment of women by male scientists gotten worse since the beginning of your career?
No. I'm sure it's not any worse now than it was when I started. It might even be better, but it is very much a hidden problem. I mean, I'm grateful to Azine and Michael for bringing some of these stories to light. I think the problem is, as they've explained, that your career is so dependent on, you know, your mentors, that if one of them is harassing you, you complain about it at the risk of your career. I personally didn't know how pervasive this was. I thought it was terrible when it happened, but that perhaps it was rare. I'm not sure why I thought that, but maybe because we don't hear about many cases. But I've learned since the Marcy case broke, really, I've learned from young women in astronomy that there are, you know, lots of people who have encountered sexual harassment.
Yeah, in fact, we have a clip of one anthropologist, Dr. Meredith Righteous, describing the disbelief she faced when she reported being assaulted by an advisor during a field research trip.
Senior researchers and administrators came up with a variety of stories about what had happened. They said that I was either a lesbian or had already been sleeping with the senior researcher. I requested two things. I requested that they acknowledge that something had happened and that some remedial action be taken with the person who had approached me so inappropriately. But instead, they told me to apologize to the senior researcher for the distress that I had caused him by my unfounded accusations. I apologized. He did not accept the apology and withdrew from the project, leaving a gap where his expertise had been.
Wow. Dr. Urey, why aren't women believed when they report these experiences?
You know, that's an amazing quote. A lot of us were kind of jolted by a similar study in 2014 by Kate Clancy, who's also an anthropologist, who looked into how scientists who do their research in the field, so they're away from home, you know, staying remotely somewhere else, how they encounter sexual harassment. And it was an extremely high fraction of both men and women. It's about 70% of men and 85% of women were reporting that they were harassed or assaulted. It was happening everywhere. The difference, men were typically approached by peers, and women were typically approached by superiors. So that was really, you know, it's really an eye-opener. And astronomers also go to, you know, we do our research at telescopes in many cases. So very similar stuff happening in our, you know, in the same way. I think you need the combination of two ingredients to have a sort of a high potential for this bad behavior. One is uneven numbers. So women are a pretty small fraction of many of the physical sciences, for example. And then the hierarchy that Azine mentioned, where, you know, somebody has a fair amount of power over their, you know, their graduate students or their postdocs.
Azine, what are the reforms you've seen proposed in the wake of these scandals?
Sure. I just wanted to point out one thing. I mean, in terms of women being believed, I think that's a problem that we see outside of science across the board in terms of these issues around sexual harassment, sexual assault, rape. And we're seeing that national conversation, you know, mm-hmm. really broaden in terms of figuring out why even police departments don't, you know, believe women when they come to them with rape cases, for example. But as far as what's being done, I mean, Meg addressed the professional societies, I think, have really taken on a lot of the responsibility in terms of, you know, a local approach to trying to address these problems and have sort of more checks, you know, if to sort of supplement what the universities are able to do. At a bigger level, I think, you know, we have Congresswoman Spear, Jackie Spear, who has introduced legislation requiring universities to disclose if PIs have been have had a sexual harassment complaint lodged against them, if there was an investigation, to provide that to grant funders. So at that's sort of taking a step, the step of accountability above the universities, holding them accountable in terms of, you know, whether they will receive research funding. And that's obviously been, you know, that was a huge factor in the conversations around Marcy and Cates, is they were bringing in tremendous amounts of money to their universities. And, you know, there were a lot of questions about whether there are incentives for universities to sort of let these things slide or look the other way or keep them quiet.
Got to say goodbye to Azine Gureishi of BuzzFeed News and Michael Balter for The Verge. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to come back after the break and continue our discussion of extra hurdles women face in scientific careers. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about sexual harassment and gender bias in the sciences, a conversation taped last December that we'd like to hear again. We were just talking about the new attention being drawn to sexual assault and harassment of female researchers and what it might take to ensure that women can embark on scientific careers free of unwanted attention from men who have control over their success. But what about other inequities that might be holding back their careers? Women are getting a larger proportion of science PhDs than ever, yet they remain a minority of tenured faculty. What's the problem? Is the glass ceiling any tougher in the glass laboratory? We've been talking with Meg Urey, professor of astronomy and physics at Yale, past president of the American Astronomical Society. And I want to bring in two others who have been closely scrutinizing equity and opportunity for women in science. Cassidy Sojimoto is an associate professor of informatics at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. And Kuhaley Dutt is assistant director of academic affairs and diversity at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. She is also co-author of the book Women in the Geosciences. But I want to welcome both of you to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us on the show.
You're welcome. Let me begin with you, Dr. Urey. How has the climate for women in science changed since you started? You said it was a lot worse. Feels like it's getting better a little bit.
Yeah, there's a big difference from when I was a student. I'm quite old now. So, you know, things have clearly changed. There are many more women. There are more people of color. But I would also say the pace of change is maddeningly slow. I mean, we used to have 10% of medical students were women. Now it's 50%, more than 50%. But women are not being hired anywhere near those numbers as faculty in medical schools. And you find the same thing in biology. Parity at the undergraduate and graduate levels, but not parity at the assistant professor level. So we have, and physics, sorry, I didn't even mention physics and engineering are like way behind the life sciences. So we have a long way to go.
Kohaley, you're nodding your head a lot.
It's very similar to the geosciences, where about 40% of the PhDs go to women, but at the full professor level, there's less than 10% women. So it's very similar to what Meg has just said about physics and engineering and, you know, the other sciences.
So it doesn't vary much by field.
Apparently not.
Cassidy, your research looks at things like how often men and women are cited in their research. Turns out it's kind of complicated, right?
Well, I think it shows and repeats some of the things that we've heard before, these invariant gender disparities regardless of discipline. Our studies have reconfirmed that men's voices matter more in science. They're more likely to be in leading roles, they produce more, and their work is more highly cited. Some of those complexities do come when we start to dig down into the places in which they're putting their work. So we find that women, particularly those in heavily male-dominated fields, engineering and other fields like this, tend to publish in more prestigious journals, that is, journals with higher journal impact factors. However, even when they place their work in these journals, their work receives fewer citations.
Hmm. Has that been constant? That has not gone up or down at all?
You know, we're starting to see better equality in these, but as was mentioned earlier, the progress is very, very slow. And there are still skeptics who argue that this is due to some inherent differences in the content or quality of women's work. Yet recent studies have dispelled this myth. Modeling all the properties of articles and predicting citation rates, we find that these systematic biases still exist against work authored by women.
Mm-hmm. Kohaley, when women want to go for another job and they need a letter of recommendation, are they getting those?
Well, that's the study that my co-authors and I, we just finished. And what we found, well, other fields such as medicine, psychology, chemistry, and biochemistry, they had already had these studies done on letters of recommendation, and there wasn't such a study for the geosciences, and so we did this. But what we found was that our results were very similar in that men were consistently, they received more of these outstanding letters, and women were much less likely to receive them. And when I say outstanding letters, I mean the ones that portray the applicant to be this top-notch scientist, this role model, this leader, this pioneer, this rising star. Those tend to go more to men than to women. And the other surprising thing that we found that the gender of the letter writer didn't seem to matter. Whether it was a male writing the letter or a female writing the letter, it was very similar. And also the sense is that some of these biases, it's probably more to do with widespread cultural stereotypes than any conscious intent to harm someone. But that's something, that's a challenge that women face. And this was, the other thing is that letters of recommendation is just one piece of this. Funding, publications, callback for interviews, race and gender. They have actually done studies on all of these things and found differences.
What? Yeah, if I could just add something. If you look at the major metrics that we consider when we're hiring someone or when we're trying to promote them or give them tenure, every single one of them has been shown to be biased by gender. So we heard about citations and letters of recommendation, funding and proposals. There are a number of astronomy studies that show that women have less chance of getting their proposals accepted. Whether people are invited speakers or win prizes, those are biased by gender. Teaching evaluations, even the status of the publications, as was mentioned earlier. So all these things that are how we measure excellence are systematically biased against women. And some of your listeners may wonder whether it's bias or the women just aren't as good. And most of these experiments do careful things to sort of check for that, and they don't find any measures of women not being as good. Indeed, to do as well in a review, they have to be many times better.
You're nodding again.
Yes, because, there are actually studies that specifically tested for bias and found exactly that. So when faculty were asked to rate applicants for a lab manager position, this is science faculty, they were given two identical applications. One had a male name and one had a female name. And both male and female faculty ended up rating the male applicant much higher, calling him more competent and more hireable. That wasn't one study. Mm. They did another study with CVs where they just changed the male name and a female name on the CV, and they got a very similar result. Same with funding. NIH did, well, they commissioned a study later for race, but prior to that, there was the study done that looked at funding, and they found that women received only about 60% or two-thirds of the funding that men received.
You know, I'll throw this out to you. Let me ask Cassidy first. You know, you would think that of all the professions in the world, whether you're a lawyer or a doctor, if you're a scientist, you depend on the facts, right? You should be listening more.
Right. We would hope that in all fields we shouldn't see the systematic discrimination against women in the knowledge economy, but we do, and we also see it in the distribution of labor roles. And I think a lot of it goes back to that when we see women working in science in different ways. So one of the studies that we looked at saw what people were doing in order to contribute to the authorship of a paper, and we found that men were more likely to be granted authorship for conceptual tasks, like designing or writing the study, whereas women are granted authorship for technical tasks. So in short, women were at the hands of science, but men were choosing which questions to ask. And I think that relates to a lot of these things, these letters of recommendation, these systematic biases, when women are perceived as a different kind of scientist doing different kinds of labor in science. So a lot of these discriminations are both implicit, but many explicit biases that still happen in the knowledge economy.
I also found it interesting that what you said, Kohaley, is that sometimes it's the women discriminating against women, too. Is that because it's just built in, or is it?
Yes, I mean, I think
is it cultural over all this time?
Yes, I think it's sort of a widespread cultural stereotype rather than any conscious negativity. But the other thing that was very interesting is that there was the study that said that this was not just limited to science. For example, there were fields like the biological sciences and life sciences where you have more numbers of women in those fields. And then on the other hand, in the you have fields like philosophy, a non-scientific field, which is very, very male dominated. And so there was a study, and there what they stated was that it wasn't necessarily about women or science. It was about whether there was a perception that you needed raw innate talent to be successful in that field. And women were generally stereotyped as not having that sort of brilliance to be successful in that field. And it wasn't just women. They found African Americans as well were stereotyped as not being brilliant enough to be in those fields.
Mm-hmm. Megiri, you were on a committee approving proposals for time at the Hubble Space Telescope, and research has found that even that has been a process biased against women. And if you weren't aware, how could anyone be aware?
Exactly. I was running the proposal review when these biased results were happening. They were very small differences, and so they weren't visible in any one cycle. And the people at Space Telescope Science Institute applaud them for what they've done. In looking at 25 years of review data, they could actually see a significant signal. It is very subtle, and we all do it. It's not men doing it to women or white people doing it to black people. We all have biases which are formed by the society we grew up in. And so, but I think in science, maybe the problem is just a little bit more stubborn, because objectivity is a core value for a scientist. As you said, this is how we do our work, supposedly. And so people are very resistant to the idea that they're not objective. There's a lovely piece of research that I won't recite the whole thing for you, but basically the people who thought they were objective were the ones most liable to make a biased decision, to actually switch criteria in midstream to agree with the gender of applicants for a particular job. And it was only the people who said they were not objective, who were self-aware that they had some biases, who were able to behave in a more objective way. So I think we really have a problem here where we need to get people to understand they have biases that they don't even realize.
And women, as you pointed out, also aren't the only group working for representation in science. Can people of color, women of color, others, all benefit about a conversation about women, Kohaley?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, some of the research that shows that the challenges that women face in science, it's very similar for minorities, specifically underrepresented minorities in science. They're up against these same challenges. And, for example, going back to the gender thing, following on Meg's point, there was a study where they showed that male faculty were very resistant to the idea. They were very skeptical that gender bias actually exists in science. Mm-hmm. Similarly, in a Pew Center study, they found that whites were much less likely to believe that there's racial inequity in society than blacks were. And there was an NIH study that NIH actually commissioned, and, you know, kudos to them for commissioning it and also making the results public, where they found that a black PhD scientist was far less likely to get funded than a white PhD scientist from a similar institution with a similar scientific record. So these biases run very deep. And like I mentioned about the earlier study where they thought that African Americans don't have that, you know, the sort mm-hmm. of brilliance needed for these fields. And another issue is that, following on this thing about people being very resistant to it, I mean, sometimes we hear, in searches, we hear comments like, let's not look at race or gender, let's just look at merit. And that is, I mean, not only does that show that this person really doesn't know much about how implicit bias works, but these sorts of comments also give rise to a very damaging perspective that there's a trade-off between diversity and excellence, so that if you're hiring a woman or a minority, you're somehow compromising on the quality and the standards that you would expect in science.
Hmm. We're talking about discrimination in science, and especially women minorities, at this hour on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And talking with Cassidy Tsujimoto, Kueli Dutt, and Meg Urey. In the few minutes that we have left, is there any optimism among my panel here about getting better? Cassidy, Meg, I'll go around the table, my non-table
sure,
here.
I mean, I believe in optimism. I think now is a particularly a time for optimism, and it's true we've seen advances in gender equity in both production and impact and in a lot of these variables we've talked about. However, modeling our current rates of production and impact, it will still be decades before we reach parity. And frankly, as a mother of two daughters, I'm not content to wait that long. I believe we need to do more to sort of reduce this overwhelming skepticism about the bias, to train people, have conversations about implicit bias, to look critically about how we run our labs and distribute our labor. And I think we need to continue to do research that brings light to these disparities, whether it's about gender, race, social class, citizenship, or other variables that impede our progress in terms of a healthy scientific system.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else want to add?
Yes, absolutely. So, for example, at Lamont Doherty at Columbia, where I work, about 8 to 10 years ago, at the junior ranks, and I mean like at the assistant research professor ranks, we had less than 18% women. And now that figure is somewhere between 40 and 45% women. And that is a result of very conscious institutional efforts to address the problem. The issue is very different with underrepresented minorities because when you take African Americans, Hispanics, and Native Americans together, they account for about 5% of the PhDs in the geosciences. So that's a different problem there. But yes, I definitely think that there has been progress, and more institutions are now becoming aware of the need to do something mm-hmm. and taking steps to do it.
I've seen the same. I have to say, we see more talk about implicit bias. People are aware of what it means, and I've seen changes. You know, in department meetings and in the conversations in the hall. So I think it's going forward. You know, we really have to get this right because so many of the challenges facing the nation in the next right. decade or two are technical and scientific.
Where's the conversation not happening? Where it should be happening? If it's happening in the halls and with your colleagues, where is it not happening? I mean, you think it's happening in all the places it should be?
Well, I think it's still a minority. I think there's still quite a few skeptics who don't believe there's anything wrong. You know, frankly, American science is extraordinarily successful. We typically get a couple Nobel Prizes every season, and, you know, we have amazing discoveries that have fueled our economy. So people look at that and say it's as good as it could possibly be. And what I hope people are thinking about is the people you haven't tapped, in your profession, the white men are a shrinking fraction of the pie in this country. And if we're not tapping all the talent that's out there, we're not doing as well as we could. This is, you know, exactly the point Kueli was making, but let me make it explicit that excellence and diversity are aligned. If we don't get it right, we are not as good as we can be.
Well, that's a good place to end it. Let me thank all of you for a stimulating conversation. Cassie Sugimoto, Associate Professor of Informatics at Indiana University in Bloomington. Kohele Dutt is Assistant Director of Academic Affairs and Diversity at Columbia's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory and co-author of Women in the Geosciences. Meguri, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Yale and past President of the American Astronomical Society. Thank you all for this great conversation.
Thank you so much for bringing attention to it.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We frequently bring on actor Alan Alda to talk about, well, talking about science. He's a veteran, after all, in talking to scientists and teaching them to communicate better. And some of the methods he suggests may seem strange at first, like ranting about something, for example, or trying to talk in sync with another person. But as an actor trained at getting inside people's heads, he thinks his insights can help the rest of us get our ideas across better, because it all comes down to empathy. And without further ado, needing almost no introduction, Alan Alda, actor, director, screenwriter, founder of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University. He's got a new book, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? It's good to see you, Alan.
Hi, Ira.
How did you choose that name for the book?
Well, interestingly, you know, it's a book about communicating and relating to other people. So I thought a funny title would be, Huh? My editor didn't think that was so good. So I searched some more. And actually, I like this title better because, Huh? kind of focuses on the negative. You know, I don't get it. But the title, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face, really kind of points you to what the point I'm trying to make in the book, which is that the other person, the person you're trying to communicate with, is the one you have to focus on, not what you want to say, what you want them to know. You got to know who they are, where they are in their head while you're communicating with them. You can't always know that, but yeah, if the better estimate you can make of it, whether you're talking to them, whether you're talking to one person or a crowd or writing for them, you have to make an estimate of what they're thinking as you talk, if you possibly can.
Can you learn that as you talk to them?
Yes.
Some sort of idea.
It's in real time. Because let's say you think, okay, communicating is getting the best possible message that makes this perfectly clear. And I start talking to you, and I find out you're not ready for what I have to say. You need something before that. I made a visit to CERN a couple of years ago, and I was very excited. They were hot on the trail of the Higgs, or maybe they had just found the Higgs. So I was back having dinner with a friend, and at the dinner table, she said, tell us all about the Higgs boson. What is that? So I said, well, it's a particle that makes up the Higgs field, and it has the – she said, wait a minute. What's a particle? So I had to go back, yeah. You know, much yeah. earlier than I thought I did. If she didn't say that, if she didn't stop me, I would have gone on and be talking more and more Greek to her.
But what you're saying is that to be a good communicator, you have to be a good listener, too.
I think you have to listen better than the person you're communicating with.
Hmm.
Because you have to not only be aware of what you're saying and adapt what you're saying, you have to pick up as many clues as you can from them. In the title of the book, you're picking up clues from the face. But there are all kinds of clues you can pick up. The tone of voice, what do they seem to be feeling as you talk to them?
Yeah.
You know, that's where empathy comes in.
Empathy.
Yeah. I think empathy is a really important part of it. I don't know if you can do good communication without having an awareness of what the other person is going through, especially emotionally, but their point of view. What's their point of view? And if you have that in mind, if you can keep adjusting to that, I think your chances of communicating are far better. So the training that we do,
right,
which you were talking about a second ago, is how do these odd moments that we have in training in our workshop exercises, how do they lead to this? Well, what they all do, as strange as they might seem to the people going through them, what they do is put you in touch with another person so that you read them really well. You get habituated to reading another person, and that gives you the chance to have a clue about what they're going through as you communicate with them.
So you think being a good listener is something you can train somebody to do?
And you can train people to have more empathy. You don't always call it that, but that's what's happening. It enables a closer connection, a more personal connection to the person you're trying to communicate with. And what happens, I think, is that the other person becomes your communicating partner, not the target of your communication. There's a big difference. It's ping pong instead of archery, you know, where I'm trying to shoot arrows of knowledge into your head.
It's speaking of the connection and speaking about your emphasis about empathy, with our society is so polarized now, it's very difficult for people who don't agree to have any that connection or
that
empathy.
It really is. It really is. And I think that some of the work that people are doing to try to bridge that gap kind of reflects on the value of what we're doing in our workshops, because one of the things that we bring about through this connection we establish is a sense of commonality, a sense of community, a sense of familiarity. And those people who seem much better at communicating with audiences who are pretty iffy about accepting the concept, say, of global warming, they do much better before they ever get into that subject if they establish what they have in common, what their concerns are, what their upbringing was like, you know, what the connections between the two people are in terms of similarities. Once they do that, and there have been a number of studies that show teaching gets better when the teacher and the student know about similarities that they have. It almost is an automatic thing that happens. Some door opens, a channel opens up. So the polarization in the country may eventually come about by people communicating along the lines that we're finding work with scientists and doctors. And now we've spread it out. And the book is really about, and I love this, the scientists themselves were telling us this, what this work is really about. One guy came up to us and said, "This training has saved my marriage." And that's
unintended consequences.
Yeah. And good ones too. And that's really what most of the book is about how all of us can use it in our everyday lives, parents and teachers and teenagers and their parents and lovers, husbands and wives. It's really amazing that there's what we have found in in the past 8 years we've been working with 8,000 scientists wow. and doctors. We've had them in workshops, and another 30,000 we've given talks to where we explain what we're doing. But the workshop is the real experience where it happens. And what we found working with them is that this connection that we establish is something basic to all communication. And I'll tell you where this is a personal experience I had that I think was very. It's in the book. I don't own up to it as a personal experience. So you're getting the.
We won't tell anybody.
You know, no, nobody's listening, right?
That's right.
So, just millions of people with a pencil in their hand. But if you want to do some good with knowing how the other person feels, empathy can get you over the hump and get you to actually do it. For instance, this is a thing that was personal to me, but I said in the book, a husband comes home late at night.
I wonder who that is.
It turned out to be me. So his wife, my wife, was already asleep in bed, and I pass by the kitchen sink, and I see this huge pile of dishes in the sink. And I say, I guess I ought to do something about that. That's an impulse to do something positive. What are the chances I'm going to do something? Not so great. It's midnight. It'll last till the morning. But then I had this little moment of empathy where I could feel what she was feeling. And I thought, when she wakes up in the morning, what is she going to feel when she looks in that sink? And I thought, hey, I'm going to clean it up. The empathy didn't make me do something good, but it enabled me to do something. It was a tool I could use. And in the same way, it's a tool we can use to communicate with one another, to share knowledge.
Can scientists use empathy to communicate?
I think they have to. I think they have to keep aware of who they're talking to. Here's an interesting thing. You know, we talk about emotion and storytelling being really important.
Right.
Mostly, scientists are trained for good reason not to include emotion and storytelling when they talk to other scientists, when they write papers explaining their work, hoping for replication and that kind of thing. That makes sense because I personally don't want a scientific discovery or a feat of engineering to be successful because somebody has a cute personality. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to have somebody say, the guy who built this bridge is a really nice guy. Why don't you take a walk across? I want to have a little more assurance than that. So I understand, and I even understand why jargon is used. If you can say in one word something that takes 5 pages to explain to a layperson, but you're talking to a fellow scientist, use the one word if they understand you. However, if they're not in your field, you maybe need to explain it in layman's terms. You know, when the nanoscientists and neuroscientists got together in Washington to talk about the Obama Brain Initiative, they argued for hours and hours about the meaning of the word probe, an ordinary English word, but they came in from different viewpoints. So you have to know who you're talking to. Are you talking to an audience that needs to hear more technical language, or are you talking to the rest of us?
Do you think that if scientists became better storytellers, that they'd be able to communicate?
Yeah, I think so. We one of the modules we teach is storytelling. I personally like, because I come from the stage, I like what Aristotle said about what makes a good story in the theater work, which is dramatic action, where I'm a hero and I'm trying to achieve something. I'm trying to get somewhere to a great, valuable goal. Well, if the story is simply, that's what I want and that's what I got, it's not much of a story to me. But his idea of dramatic action was, I'm on the way to get this great thing and there's an obstacle suddenly put in my path and I got to fight my way through that obstacle to get to the golden trophy at the end. That's interesting to watch. And what's funny is if you say sometimes to scientists in our workshop, for instance, you say, tell us the story of your work. Tell us the story of one of your experiments. You said, yeah, I don't have a story. And then it turns out that the beaker broke and 6 months of their data was lost or something
like
that.
They do have a story.
Everybody has a story, but we don't think automatically of that.
In case you just joined us, we're talking to Alan Alda, founder of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook. And he's author of a really interesting new book, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? On Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Well, you know, I remember a seminal story we did many years ago on Science Friday. A listener, we were talking about vaccination and autism. And we were talking about one of the chief scientists who worked in the field said he had a mound of data on his desk that showed that there was no connection between vaccination and autism. And I had a woman caller who came on, and she spoke very well. I gave her a whole 8 minutes to talk by herself. It's the longest monologue of a listener I've ever had on. and when she was done, I asked her, is there any amount of evidence that I could show you, that anybody could show you, that would change your mind about this? And she paused and said, no, I just don't believe anything my government says.
I
said, thank you very much, you know, for your opinion. Now we know what the terrain looks like.
Yeah, it's very interesting. There's that meme out there about the government. I just read a story about Iowa, where a person's friends in Iowa don't use the term public schools. They call them government schools, and they don't want their children to go to government schools. So we have to communicate with one another. We have to get back to where we can speak the
same
language.
But that means you would have to empathize, as you say, with what they're going through with this, or understand at the same time.
Yeah, well, how did they arrive at that, at that point of view, and how can you share your point of view and listen to one another without name-calling? I don't think that can get us anywhere. But the interesting thing is, I can't remember, a few months ago there was research that seemed to show on the very issue of vaccination that the more I believe the outcome of the research was the more data you tell somebody whose mind is made up about vaccination, the more data you give them, the less likely they are to change their minds.
Yeah.
Now, maybe that's because they don't have a relationship with the concept of data that we have. And maybe that's a chasm that needs to be breached.
Or, as to take a page out of your book, maybe they can't empathize with someone who is suffering from that disease. And I think, like polio, we both grew up in the era of when people were in iron lungs.
That's
In fact, I
had polio when I was seven.
And
so
we can empathize with you and other people about the need for vaccination.
Right. And I thought you were going to say, maybe you were saying, that we can empathize with a parent who has a child with the condition of autism.
Yes.
Instead of going right into facts, the human connection, the sense of what that person must be going through must be terrible. And to be able to know what the solution is, even the facts contradicted, must be relief.
Yeah. Do we need to practice empathy?
Yes, that's what I've found, at least in my own life, and I see it in the people we work with. This is a strange thing, and I don't understand it. We have the capacity for empathy. It feels good when we exercise it. Things go so much better. The more empathic I am, the less annoying other people are. I love that. Yet, it wears off after a while, and I need a booster shot. And I've developed exercises that I do during the day, almost like going to the gym. It's like the empathy gym. And I keep getting back in touch with – I just did it on the way into the studio with the driver. He went a roundabout route, and I had asked him to go a different route. And I had an impulse to be snarky. And I thought about what he was going through. And I got connected to him in a way that relieved me of the need to be snarky. And I got here in the same amount of time. What difference did it make? I find I need a booster shot every once in a while.
Well, we all do. And you'll get a great booster shot from Alan Alda's new book, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? It's out from Random House right now. Alan Alda, actor, director, screenwriter, founder of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook. Always a pleasure to have you, Alan.
It always is a pleasure to be here, Iris. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. We had engineering help from Neil Rausch and Brian McCabe, and thanks to the rest of the folks at NPR. You can email us at scifry@sciencefriday.com, or you can tweet us at scifry, or go to our Facebook site. We're everywhere. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.